I'm here with author James LaRue, the executive director of Garfield County Public Library District, discussing his new book, On Censorship, A Public Librarian Examines Cancel Culture in the U.S. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
So, starting out, what motivated you to write a book on the topic of book censorship? And can you share a little bit about your background, how your background as a librarian has influenced your approach to this subject?
I began as a public library director in Douglas County, Colorado. And in the time that I was there from 1990 through 2014, I received and responded to over 250 challenges. And those challenges mean somebody officially requests either that you eliminate the resource, you know, book, magazine, program, exhibit, whatever, or you restrict access to it. And 250 challenges is more than almost any library I had ever spoken to. And I thought, well, how interesting. What's all that about? And finally got to the point where I realized that first I thought it was a left against right or religious against secular. But eventually, I think it was more generational. It was about kind of a growing parental protectiveness where they just didn't want their children to be exposed to the wolves in the woods. And then after I left Douglas County, I went to work for the American Library Association, and I was the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom. And this is an agency where if someone tries to censor library materials, they're supposed to call the Office for Intellectual Freedom. And we tried to help them respond or get more reviews or figure out the best way to talk about this with their community. And while I was there, I dealt with another close to 1,000 attempts to restrict materials across America. And then I eventually wound up relocating here to the Western Slope in Colorado. I'm now a rural library administrator, which is fascinating. And now I'm kind of coming in to experience what many libraries across the United States are experiencing, which is what we call a surge. And this is where all of a sudden a whole bunch of people show up at a public meeting. They follow a very similar pattern. They're not just complaining about a single book, they're complaining about lots of them. So it's 15 to 20, or in the case of Texas, it's 850 books all at once. And so this list of books sort of comes from unknown places. But almost always the challenges are directed against books by or about LGBTQ or by or about people of color. And so even though the language tends to be, well, this is inappropriate for children or this is all about sex, when you dig into it, it's not about sex. It's about anything that is not just white, straight people. And so that's what the challenges are about. So as I began to notice that the number of these challenges were picking up, increasing all across the country, and getting a little scary in that in some places, in Idaho and Oklahoma and Texas, the idea was that it's not just that the book itself is pornographic or wrong, but that if I object to it and the librarian doesn't immediately remove it from the collection, I can sue the librarian for $10,000. It becomes a felony on their record, and they can't pay the fine with the GoFundMe. So it's like there's something worrisome about what's happening with these library challenges, and I wanted to explore that.
In your opinion, what's the cause for this increase in censorship? Like, why is this movement picking up all of a sudden?
Well, and I think that there's something like four main reasons why people challenge things. The first one is, it's just often childhood trauma. And in my book, I talk about this, like when I was a kid, I was traumatized by Brussels sprouts. I hate Brussels sprouts. Forced to eat them, didn't like the taste. And so I still have this kind of hatred of Brussels sprouts. And one of the things I talk about is like, I remember walking into a grocery store and seeing a big display in the frozen food aisle of Brussels sprouts. So I go up to a manager and I say, I'm offended by Brussels sprouts. Don't I have the right not to see Brussels sprouts when I walk into a grocery store? And the manager that I spoke to said something that I think really applies to libraries. He said, nobody comes to the grocery store because we don't have what you don't want. Some people like Brussels sprouts. And so I think that many people just complain about stuff because they had a bad experience with it. So it's just individual trauma. And then the second thing that happens, and this was like the first book I wrote about censorship for librarians, was that I noticed that the common denominator for many of the challenges in libraries was parents of children between the ages of 4 and 6, or parents of children between the ages of 14 and 16. And I realized, being a father myself, is like, what happens from 4 to 6 is a life transition. It's the end of infancy and it's the beginning of childhood. And parents kind of panic. They freak out. Oh my God, I want to reestablish control over my child's environment, because now they're being exposed to play dates and preschool and, you know, all these other kinds of daycare sort of settings where they're being exposed to things the parents aren't comfortable about. 14 to 16, same thing. Now it's the end of childhood and the beginning of adulthood. And in both of those cases, I think what happens is parents freak out and they say, I want my baby back. I just don't want them to grow up. I want to preserve that innocence as long as possible. Typically, after that 2-year period in the transition, you realize you may have lots of things to worry about, but libraries probably aren't one of them. Libraries are pretty helpful places. Now, then I think like this new surge that's coming up is, there are two aspects of it. The first one is kind of a demographic panic. So just like parents freak out when they see these changes, many people have looked around in the United States and they say, you know what, America is becoming less white. And many people feel like, you know, even if they don't think of themselves as overtly racist or bigoted, there's still this kind of sense of, I have a privilege. And if other people are coming up, more brown people, more LGBTQ people, that somehow threatens my privilege. And I think there's a demographic panic. I don't want things to change. And I'm very intrigued by the fact that as I take a look at the books that have been challenged with me and the books that were challenged at the Office for Intellectual Freedom, it's like all of the challenges are focused on 3% of what we collect in libraries. That 3% are the new voices, previously marginalized voices in American society. And so people on the right will say, ooh, fend those off. You know, I don't want change. We like things the way they are. Just don't talk about those people. Just only talk about white, straight people. And then on the other hand, on the left side, I have people that say, you know what? On the contrary, absorb as many of these new voices as you possibly can. And while you're about it, let's go back and clean up all those people who were not as woke as we are. And so the job of the librarian is to say, we just hold up a mirror to the culture. This is what's going on in society. And if you don't like what you see in the mirror, you don't blame the mirror, right? You blame what you see in the mirror. And so libraries track social change. 97% of what we've got still looks backward. It's still that mirror. 3% is the new voices. And then I think finally, the fourth reason that many people challenge library materials, it's for power and for money. I mean, I really believe somebody stands up and they say, this book, Beloved by Toni Morrison, is about sex. Well, if you read the whole book, and many people who challenge materials don't, they just find the naughty bits and they read the snippets and they say, this is outrageous. But if you read the whole thing, you realize it's far deeper, more complicated, more meaningful. That's an important discussion to have. So I don't think that people are really complaining about what they say they're complaining about. It goes viral, they protest it, they get, you know, clicks and likes, and they ask for money and they get it. And so the focus is now shifting to an overtly political, overtly power-driven drive to have control over what other people can read.
When we think about censorship, in your opinion, where's the line between protecting individuals from, you know, potentially harmful content and preserving freedom of expression in literature?
Yeah, you know, this whole idea about harmful, reading is harmful, I just don't believe that. My sense is that I've never seen anybody harmed by a book. And I also think that, as, you know, parents are saying, as my child is growing up, I don't want them to know this. Well, which is the better protection for your child? Do you want them to find out something that, you know, about how cruel the world can be, about how nasty it is, about sexual abuse, about drugs? Do you want them to find out on the street? Or do you want them to find out in a book where they can think about it and read about it and talk about it in the safety of the library? And so my feeling is that, you know, in my experience, again, raising two kids in my own life, if I read something that I don't understand, I don't understand it. It goes over my head. If I read about it and I need to know about it, then I'm old enough, whether my parents think I'm old enough or not. And it's often the case, you know, that somebody comes into the library, and I had this happen when I was in Douglas County, where someone comes in and says, okay, I'm 7 years old and I already know that I'm different from other people. I already know that I'm not straight. And children would come in looking through these books, trying to find out what's wrong with me. And if they can't find anything, they become even more isolated. And my feeling is that libraries tell not only the story of our society, we tell the human story. Not everybody has the same experience as yours. And in fact, I believe that by reading about people whose lives are not exactly like yours, you have the chance to grow in compassion, grow in an understanding, and I think it makes you a better citizen, a better human being. So my response to all that kind of conflict is that, don't worry, your children are not reading too much. That's not a problem. That in fact, the more they read and the more they talk about this, the more likely they are to understand what's going on in the world and to thrive.
In your position, what are some of the most memorable books that have been challenged?
Well, I was really intrigued by this, is that I thought at first all the books were going to be about LGBTQ, but when I was in Douglas County, most of the challenges I got were about fairy tales. And I got two on the same day about Little Red Riding Hood. And in the first case, the traditional story is, you know, Little Red is going off and she has a basket with a bottle of wine and a baguette. She meets the wolf runs ahead of her, eats Granny, hops on the bed, she comes in, says, oh, what big eyes you have. And as the wolf is chasing her around, the woodman comes in, conks the wolf on the head, slices him open, and Granny steps out fine, whole. And at the very end, she's having a glass of wine with the woodman. And the complaint was, Granny is a drunk, that you are promoting senior alcoholism. And I thought that was pretty funny. And my response to this was that, you know, if I had been Granny and I'd just been sliced out of a wolf, I'd want a drink. I don't think that's out of line. In the second challenge, not only was Granny eaten, but so was Little Red. And the final picture of the picture book was the shadow of the woodman at the door. And this time the woman complained. She said, I picked up this book and I glanced through it before I read it to my daughter, and I didn't read it because I thought she would be afraid. And that's what made me realize that children are drawn to the woods, right? The woods are scary and dark and interesting, and it grabs your attention. And the parents get that, but they don't want there to be wolves in the woods. They want woods without wolves. The problem is, there are wolves in the woods, and children need to know how to deal with them. And I continue to believe that the best way to do that is to read about it. So I think that was where I got the big insight that if you go all the way back to like Grimm Brothers fairy tales, Little Red didn't make it. There was no woodman. The point was, don't talk to strangers. And the reason we're drawn to literature is because we need to develop imaginative antibodies to the many ills in the world.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in now, I'm here with author James LaRue, the executive director of Garfield County Public Library District, discussing his new book, On Censorship, A Public Librarian Examines Cancel Culture in the U.S. You mentioned in your book that book banning is mainly a minority opinion. How do you think that this minority opinion is able to gain enough influence to challenge the availability of certain books?
I guess I'll go back to the fascinating case of what happened in Wellington. This happened just last year. And so it began the way it usually begins, where somebody shows up and they say, I've got a list of 19 books here that I think are inappropriate for children. They need to be removed. And then what happened was at the next meeting, a lot of people showed up and they said, you know what, by a 2-to-1 majority, you know, clearly stronger than that, they said, who do we want to be? How do we want to be known in this community? Do we really want to be known as a community that wants to silence human exploration, wants to say reading is somehow bad, that knowledge is somehow bad? And they raised all these kinds of questions to say, that's not who we want to be. And I believe that the reason that censorship has been so successful, and I think in the past couple of years, particularly in the schools, is because they may not be a majority, these people that are trying, in the name of liberty, to prevent people from reading about things, which I would argue is not liberty at all, but they're very loud, and they are persistent, and they continue to show up. And so what I've learned is every one of these communities I've been to is that it tends to be less than, it's a very small majority, minority of people who keep complaining about this, but they show up in the newspaper, they show up online, they hand out petitions, and they just keep talking about it. What I find is that the people who tend to be more tolerant aren't as obsessive, right? We tend to say, okay, well, I read that book and it didn't appeal to me, so I'm not going to read it again, instead of agitating everything and saying, oh my God, society is falling apart.
And in your book, you discuss how values are reflected in the text of the time. You mentioned the Boy Scouts manuals from two periods of time. Could you explain a little bit how literature can serve as a mirror for societal values and implications of the time?
Yeah, this is the story about that was I was at a Rotary Club meeting, and a Scout leader said, you know, here's a Boy Scout manual from 19, I think it was 48 or something, as after World War II. And the focus there was very much about, you know, the people are so concerned about your well-being, and they thought so carefully about what it is that you need, that when you see a fire hydrant, somebody identified a source of water. Somebody laid all the pipes for this. They come out and they test the fire hydrant. So if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and your house bursts into flame, all of these thoughtful people have built systems to save your life and to save your property. By the time we get to the, I think it was like 70s or 80s, now the tone was very different. And the tone was more like, you know, hey, if you don't use these public institutions, you'll lose them. And so it was a redefinition from a focus on citizenship, rights and responsibilities of citizens in a society, to consumerism, where everything is about what you buy and how much money somebody makes and whether or not somebody uses it in a marketplace. It's more about what you're entitled to as opposed about to what you are obligated to do for the sake of others. My feeling is that this whole unraveling of public institutions, repeated attacks against public schools, against public libraries, against, you know, banks, against newspapers, against journalism, is all this repeated idea that, you know, hey, I can spend my money any way I want and I would be fine with that, overlooking the fact that very few people team up to build a highway, right? And so this larger institutional infrastructure that we have is one of the things that improves people's lives. And I think we need to rediscover that and talk more about that.
Definitely. And in your book, you talk about how, you know, sometimes you feel like it would be easier to appease to people, to appease to their, you know, to what they're asking you to do. But throughout your book, you talk about how appeasement really doesn't work in the context of book banning. So what are some alternative approaches you propose, you know, to address censorship and attempts to censor these books while still effectively promoting, you know, constructive dialogue?
Well, and that is the thing. My feeling is that often when these attacks are happening, and attacks is a pretty straightforward way to describe it. Somebody shows up and they say, this book is outrageous. The library director should be fired. In fact, I've reported them to the district attorney. Your library board should resign in shame, and we should defund the library. Well, that kind of approach doesn't lead to nuanced discussion. It doesn't lead to, you know, a meaningful conversation. And I think instead, the best way to do this is to say, you know, let's start off with a book club and let's, you know, here's the basic advice. If you have something that your child starts to read and you're worried about it, read it with your child. Begin with talking about it. In my experience, if you ban your child from reading something that upsets you, they're probably going to read it anyhow, but now they're not going to talk to you about it. And so if you want to have this dialogue, if you want to be a parent, get the library out of the middle of it, talk to your child. I think that's the single most powerful thing. Talk to your child as opposed to threatening the institution. The second thing is, I really believe that this idea, traditional idea of libraries as being common and neutral ground, rather than trying to shun controversy by, for instance, we do a Pride Month display. Why do we do a Pride Month display? Because it's in the news, because people are talking about it, because families are grappling with it. Let's put it out there so people talk about it, and let's have a program where we can bring in people and say, okay, tell me what you feel about this. Media often sets everything up as it's one extreme or the other. But the truth of it is, most of humanity is somewhere in the middle. And I think just to have a sense to say, let's have a spot where we can set some ground rules of respect, Talk about your understanding. Let's share what other people understand. And let's reach kind of a new level of understanding. You get to that not by shouting at each other, but by listening to each other. And what better place to listen than a library?
Just thinking about censorship, as an author writing about censorship, have you faced any challenges or any pushback related to your own work, and how have you handled those situations?
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. It's like one of the common things that's happening now with many of the challenges is it begins, as I say, with strangers who show up at a public meeting, haven't read the book that they're complaining about, and they begin by saying, you librarian, are a pedophile. You are a groomer. And this is, you know, out of the gate. Well, if you're an ordinary human being, you're going to say, whoa, where did that come from? And there's no evidence that I'm promoting anything like sexual abuse. You know, that's not the case in libraries. There's no evidence of that. And so it's easy for people to take this personally. And what I've learned, and it's easier sometimes than others, but I have gotten to the point where I say, you know, complaining about books, complaining about the culture is also a First Amendment protected liberty. That's okay. It's not about me. So what I say to my staff is that our job is to do the level best we can to support everyone in our community. And so if we come in and say, you know, again, we're not trying to do this to offend anybody. We're doing it to support our community, to reflect the diversity of human experience, and to have confidence that particularly at this time, with all of its disturbing echoes to around 1937, 1938, when there's this rising worldwide authoritarianism, we have to say it's not about us. It's about our culture. It's about our society. And ultimately, it's about identity. Who do we want to be? Are we authoritarians, or are we people who possess compassion and understanding?
And while making a library, you know, a safe space for somebody to find themselves and find their identity, what sort of recommendations do you have for librarians or educators or readers who want to confront book banning and censorship in their communities? What can they do?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for interviewing me about this, because I think that media and libraries have, we share this as an issue. How do we begin to say, if someone is trying to suppress access to ideas, take the Florida Don't Say Gay Bill, take the anti-critical race theory in Texas, suddenly whole topics are being taken off the table. How can we claim to be a nation devoted to liberty and the freedom of inquiry when we're trying to deliberately suppress access to information? What's the best we can do? Keep talking about it. Keep setting in front of people. I'm trying to be very respectful but direct to the people who are challenging this. I say, you know, if no one is making you read a book, if you're not happy with what you see there, write a better one. You know, write a book and bring in and let's talk about it. But ultimately, it's like this idea of simply trying to suppress something or to bully someone into silence is ultimately a hypocritical act. We can't both say we believe in freedom of inquiry unless you ask the wrong question.
As we kind of wrap up, is there anything else you think that readers should know, that listeners should know about book censorship and about what you've been writing about? You know, is there anything we haven't touched on yet?
I guess it's just this idea that we are in a time of change. And it's, you know, it's generational change, it's political change, it's climate change. There are so many things going on. And my feeling is that far too often we allow things to be simplified too much. One of the quotes I put in my book was my favorite from H.L. Mencken. He said, to every complex problem, there's an answer that's simple, elegant, and wrong. And I think we just need to have a little more patience, a little more courage, and a little more willingness to listen before we condemn.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk with me and to speak with our listeners at KGNU.
Well, thank you, Kira. Again, I appreciate your interest.
We've been speaking with James LaRue about his new book, On Censorship, A Public Librarian Examines Cancel Culture in the U.S.